Hey everybody, I'm Chris.
Hey, I'm Bill.
Have you ever asked yourself, what is your superpower?
Everyone has a superpower. Most people just don't know what it is.
We're going to help you uncover it.
This podcast is all about helping people figure out what their truly unique superpower is.
Superpowers, what's yours?
Hello and welcome to the Superpowers podcast. We are here Corona style with Michael Katz and my partner here, Chris Cunningham.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another Superpowers podcast show. One of our first remote conversations. Hopefully we don't have too many of these and we can all be released from pandemic mania. So we have MK on from M Particle. A lot to cover on Mike's journey, both career-wise and personal. MK, before we kind of kick off, it feels sort of natural to sort of talk a little bit about how are things with you? You're out east, you're in Southampton, coping, family, your son, everyone's good?
I'm good, yeah. Everybody's good. A little bit stir crazy. Today's not super nice out, but yeah, we're hanging in. I feel like it's all kind of a mindset, right? Like there's no way around it. Like we're all stuck indoors. We're all stuck living in Groundhog's Day, and you can either tell yourself that you're okay with it and do the things that make you happy in the confines of everything that you have to deal with, or you can just kind of mope around all day. And so
it's kind of like being a founder.
Yeah, exactly. I've been miserable for years. So this is
perfect for you.
Yeah.
You're like, finally, everyone's miserable with me.
Totally. No, I'm under house arrest officially now. So it's like I'm reading.
They've been after you for years.
Totally. You know? Yeah. Okay, I actually feel bad. I didn't ask about, I forget your other dog's name. I got to ask about Maggie. So asking about your family and not asking about your dogs feels incorrect. So the question about the dogs I have is we have an 11-year-old dog, and he hasn't been walked more in his life. I actually think he's kind of confused because he's like, I'm used to two. What the hell's going on?
Yeah. I wonder, like, when everything gets back to normal, the dogs are going to be like, what the fuck just happened? I thought we were living.
During this time, consumption of food, has it gone up or down? Consumption of alcohol, consumption of TV, and consumption of reading, have they all gone up, down? What?
Reading has gone up, alcohol has gone down. I'm basically not drinking.
Good for you.
I want to come out on the other side of this better, healthier, stronger, right? Like you have to look at it as an opportunity to grow. And so that means a lot of reading, consuming a bunch of podcasts, some TV consumption. So I'm watching Ozark. I'm kind of halfway through. Have you guys caught the?
Yep.
Not caught up. Take it easy. Not caught up. Take it easy.
Yeah. I'm only like halfway through, but just trying to spend time doing things that are like productive, because it would be really easy to eat a bunch of food and to drink every night and to completely kind of let yourself go. But then it's like you get into this vicious cycle. So I'm trying to kind of hold it together.
And for our viewers out there, what book are you currently reading, or what book did you just read that you'd recommend?
Atomic Habits.
Atomic Habits.
By who? What's the give us the underlying narrative?
Who wrote it? James Clear, I want to say. And it's basically on, how to break down your behaviors to accomplish the things that you ultimately want to accomplish, and dealing with the psychology of it. I also just finished The Rise of Superman. I don't know if you guys have heard it, but it's about getting into the flow state, being able to kind of train yourself to get into a mindset where you reach like peak performance and creativity, and it goes through a bunch of really cool examples with extreme athletes. Never Split the Difference is one I've been recommending to a ton of people, by Chris Voss, who is the former FBI lead hostage negotiator. Incredible book. And awesome. then Some more stuff on just like,
if you keep going, it just turns into a brag. You've read more books in the last week than I have in the last 3 years. So congratulations. And I'm still drinking, by the way. So I'm reading less. I am keeping the workout going, but, so I think I'll meet halfway with your strategy.
I like it. Good to balance it out.
So MK, you know, our show is called Superpowers, in case you didn't get the memo. And our journey on these conversations is very much about uncovering and unearthing what's everyone's unique superpower. And we've enjoyed those conversations with previous guests, and a lot of people I think know you and your background as a serial entrepreneur, and hopefully we can uncover a little dirt and also a lot of insight about what makes MK tick. So I think a good starting point is your background and where you're from. I think, you know, the one thing that we've always had in common, at least we have one thing, the Bostonian roots. So where did you grow up? And tell us a little bit about your background, childhood. MK is a little guy.
Boston scumbags just find a way to come together. Isn't that nice?
Beautiful thing.
You know, I got to tell you, I was hoping, you know, we have an hour together. I was really hoping we didn't hit this, but for not one, not two, but 3 years, I've had to endure both of you at the Super Bowl. and I'm not really a Patriots fan, but like when you're at the Super Bowl,
we know.
You got to root for somebody. So like, do you guys both now just become Tampa Bay fans? Like what's going on? Like,
I would say the only real anxiety I've had over the past few weeks, I was like in the middle of working out last week and I had like the oh shit moment that Tom Brady is on the Buccaneers. And it was like, I kind of had to like pause because I'm like, well, what the fuck are we going to do at quarterback? And the only thing I'm praying for right now is that we sign Cam Newton. And I don't think we're going to, but I really hope that we do.
Yeah,
are you gonna root for Tampa Bay? It's hard not to.
I'm gonna root for Tom Brady and Tampa. Like they have a really good defense. Their run defense is incredible. It was like top three last year, right? So it's gonna be like I would root for Tom Brady in kind of anything he does. He was gonna go to the Adobe. He was gonna speak at the Adobe Summit, and I was gonna go just to see him speak and I kind of hate Adobe. So I don't mind rooting for the Bucks.
There you go.
Pulling for Tom, pulling for go Tampa. And we're in our reset mode, Bill. But honestly, I coped with it probably easier. There's such larger issues at hand. And the fact that he decided, at least he's winning through a pandemic with $30 million a year. But it made it a little bit easier with his departure because I can't really focus on Tom Brady at this moment.
Let's go back to young Michael.
Yeah. I grew up outside of Boston in a town called Worcester, Massachusetts.
Worcester.
I knew somebody was going to say it. I wasn't sure if it was going to be you or Bill or me.
I was definitely going to say it.
But that's the response that everybody gives when you say. When you say Worcester, you think about Tollbooth Willie, right? spent 18 years there, born and raised, and then went off to college at Syracuse, upstate New York, moved back to Boston after school, lived in and around Boston for about 5 years before starting my first company, which became InterClick.
Everyone who knows you've started all your companies with your brother. Is he your only sibling?
We have an older sister as well, and she's based out in the Bay Area, and she does, like we always joke, like she does real work. Like she's a speech therapist and works with children and the elderly. So she does incredible things, unlike us who just move data between systems.
Who's older, you or Andrew?
Me, yeah. So I'm the middle kid, which probably
explains a lot.
He's the youngest.
Now, if he was older, would he be the CEO and you'd have to be like the president?
Probably, yeah. But I pull rank on him.
Should we fast forward to your superpowers that you have a highly talented and smart brother with a tactical know-how, and it just gives you an unfair advantage?
Who, by the way, is completely fine just kind of staying back, being
kind
the
like
kind
of good hearts, like it's co-founder. Unfair, MK. Yeah. You've just been, it's just completely unfair.
Yeah. I come over the middle. I take the bumps and bruises, and he gets to kind of sit back in the pocket and enjoy it all. No, I'm kidding. Like I can't do what I do without him. And, you know, it works out great, because I think, you know, not just me being the older brother, and I think, you know, the more business minded, whereas he's the more technical minded. It also kind of frees him up to do all of the great things with the tech team and the platform that he's done over the past 20 years.
Did you guys have any co-founding stories as kids, like selling Matchbox cars or like hustling lemonade or whatever? Like, what was going on in Worcester with like AK and MK? Like, did you start doing any entrepreneurial things together at an early age? And what was that tipping point when you're like, hey, we could do some shit together. Let's do it. Probably before Interclick.
I mean, the earliest stuff that we were doing, we weren't really doing together, but like he would sell candy to his classmates in elementary school. I'd be selling like baseball cards, you know, doing all the shit that I think kids did in the 80s and probably early 90s that was like somewhat entrepreneurial, but never together, just because we're a couple of years apart.
Now, the best part about
the one more important one, Transformers or G.I. Joe?
Both, man. I was a kid of the 80s, so my parents stuck both of us in front of the TV for hours and hours and hours. So it was sugar cereal. It was as many cartoons as we could consume. I mean, the whole thing, like the fact that we're here is just absurd.
Jimmy Superfly Snuka off the top ropes.
Every time. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We were like, well, I was a big WWF fan back in the day. Like, we would beat the shit out of each other. We would brawl. In between, like, so we'd be watching TV and then a commercial would hit and it was like full on WWF fest. And then the second the commercials were done, it was like nothing had ever happened. And this was a repeat for hours and hours and hours. It was wild. It used to drive my parents fucking bonkers.
Crazy.
So the best part about being an older brother is like you can beat up your younger brother. Like, at what point can you still beat him up today if there was a fight?
For sure. Yeah. But it's also unfair because I've boxed for like 20 years at this point, and I've done Muay Thai for like 15 years. So like there's probably a lot of people I can beat up. So that's not like something I brag about or super proud of.
All right.
Yeah.
So talk about Syracuse. What did you major in? What'd you do there?
I partied. I cheated on tests. Found girls. Yeah. No, I'm kidding, or at least partly kidding. So I actually graduated with two degrees, one in finance and another in economics. And it was partly because I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. I've always loved economics. I think that was probably the better of the two degrees, but I felt like getting a finance degree would at least ensure that I was employable after college. I wasn't really sure kind of what that meant, but I knew that like finance was a place where you could go and make a bunch of money.
Did you know you wanted to stay in, like, how did you end up at Syracuse? Like I was envisioning you had like a moment from like The Town with like Ben Affleck when you're like, you got to get out of here and get really far away sort of thing. Like, how did you pick Syracuse? Did you consider Massachusetts? What other schools did you look at? I'm just curious how you ended up there.
I looked at a number of schools in the Northeast and then some in Florida, like University of Miami and University of Florida. I chose Syracuse sight unseen. It came down to Syracuse and Miami, and I was fortunate enough to have like a little bit of wherewithal to know that if I went to University of Miami, like I probably would have ended up in a gutter somewhere.
Isn't it amazing? Like, so you guys have younger kids, but yeah, when you have older kids, you go look at schools as if like, I think with my son, I looked at like 21 schools. Yeah. Me, like I got into school and I was like, hey, mom, can I visit? And they're like, listen, you'll see it when you go to move in, like, to school. You didn't go visit. You didn't go visit 21 schools and go across the country.
Yeah. Like I was going to go there and I was going to go there kind of no matter what. And it's like, that's kind of what college is about. You throw yourself into the situation and you kind of figure it out. So
I never would have thought you were an economics major. Never.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you enjoy school? Did you enjoy studying? Like, something strikes me as, did it come easy for you? Like, were you that kind of annoying guy that didn't have to work super hard, but you got good grades?
I got decent grades, and I probably could have and should have worked a little bit harder than I did. But I would argue that that's not the point of college, right? Like, that's one of the things that you should be doing in college, but you should also be enjoying college.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I always say college is about figuring out what you want to do with your life, but it's also kind of that maturation to adulthood, right? Yeah. Understanding how to live on your own, cook a little bit, you know, doing all the things you're going to need to do later in life.
Exactly. And meeting hopefully a bunch of great people that you stay in touch with for the rest of your lives.
Which you have.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. What's give us a good, do you have a good Syracuse story that you haven't shared with folks? What are your more memorable, moments, at school there?
I don't think that there's anything like super extraordinary. We had a normal, I think, normal college experience. We went to class, we went out, we drank, we hung out, we partied, we went to class, we sometimes skipped class, we kind of did everything. We did everything that I think most college kids do.
Yeah. So MK, in the story of small worlds, how small worlds get smaller. Yeah. I bought a place in the city. The building that I live only has 3 apartments per floor. So there's only 2 other people on my floor. Directly across from me is a guy who was in the same fraternity as MK in college. Talk about small worlds.
That's nice.
And I asked him, I said, hey, is there anything MK did that was crazy? And he was like, well, when he was a pledge, he got pissed off at the brothers, so he pissed in their punch right before a party. Is that true or false?
To be honest, and I'm not denying it, I don't remember. It's probably true.
I was like, that's something I could see MK doing as a like young, 19-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, like we definitely went through a bunch of stuff. I mean, this is this is mid-90s, right? Which is a kind of a far cry from what you're allowed to do these days. And so I don't know, like if especially if I was a couple drinks in, who knows what I would have done in that mindset.
No judging. So after school, your first gig, was it in Centra or Zephyr? Tell us a little, like how did you get your first job, and what were you thinking about kind of applying your finance background? Like when you started thinking about your career, was it just like, what was available? Like who's going to accept me? How do I get my first, my first gig, and trying to understand that kind of initial working for a company. And then when that shift sort of happened from when the entrepreneurial bug kicked in, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, well, second semester senior year, I started interviewing with a bunch of companies and had a couple of job offers from larger companies, including a couple banks. And then I got an offer from a company called Zephyr, which was one of the first internet consultancies. And they had just a really cool office and a bunch of free food. And it wasn't like rows and rows of cubicles in this kind of massive thing. And they were paying more. And the decision ultimately I had to make was, do I want to move back to Boston or do I want to go down to New York City with the rest of my friends? And I was like, look, college is over. Like adulthood really starts now. And that job with Zephyr started, I think, 4 days after graduation.
Right? Wow.
And so, while a bunch of my friends were taking the summer off, or at least getting like a few weeks or a month off, like I just dove in. I was like, look, this is go time. I'm on my own, and here we are, right? And so I started working, yeah, like 4 days after graduation. And you know, Zephyr was an incredible place. It was where I learned so much about building culture and using culture as an asset to drive growth, and not like bullshit culture, not just like perks and benefits and, you know, free lunch and foosball tables and that kind of stuff, but really creating values to aggregate a team of like-minded people and empowering them to do really great work and how to empower that in terms of meaningful compensation and creating highly autonomous work environments and things like that, and seeing the importance of culture in terms of creating a successful company, but then also learning how not to grow.
Yeah, what were some of the mistakes that you identified with the folks that you're working with? Like obvious things that just how you see the world and how you were born. Like, what were things that you just observed that, man, if I ever start a company, I'll never do this. I'll never take this approach.
Bro, they blew through like $100 million in like 12 months. And it was like, I'd never seen anything like that. We went from having everything at our disposal to the .com bust, and there being like a huge round of layoffs, multiple rounds of layoffs, and then there was a fire sale of the assets to NEC. By that time, I was kind of long gone, but for me, that was my first professional experience. And I'm like, wow, you really have to be mindful of the investments you make as you're growing the company. You don't just get to spend money on anything and everything.
So many people, you know, think that, you know, kind of entrepreneurism, you know, is kind of like, you know, deep rooted. At what point did you know you wanted to be an entrepreneur? Like, was it growing up? Was it in college? Was it through like the Zephyr experience? Like,
yeah. I do believe it is deep rooted. I think growing up, you know, my dad is an entrepreneur. He's always worked for himself. And so I looked at that as like, that is what I'm going to do, because that is the example of success, right?
Yeah.
And so I think it started with just seeing that every day. But as a kid, I didn't like, I don't know about you guys, but I didn't have visions of like what I wanted to be when I was older. I was just like kind of happy being a kid. Like, I know some people are like, oh, I want to be a fireman or a police. I was like, I remember thinking back, like, I just kind of want, I don't know. Like, I wanted to marry a beautiful woman. Right.
Great. Well, the it's fun. It's interesting with your, if you can touch on that a little bit, as far as what you learned from watching your dad and probably his hustle. And I don't know if your mom was working at the time or she was with three kids, but I think it'd be interesting to learn a little bit about that, kind of outside of you and your brother beating each other up and watching WWF. It'd be interesting to know like what you sort of learned and what they were doing that sort of said, this is what I want to do. It could have been the work ethic. It could have been the sacrifice.
Well, I think, you know, what it was mainly about was leadership and being a leader, not a follower. That was, you know, that's definitely something that they repeatedly kind of etched into my brain. But then it goes beyond like the parental influence. Looking back now as I'm thinking about it, I always identified with kids who had kind of the same inherent beliefs as well. So my best friends growing up, whether it was like in Worcester or at summer camp or wherever I was, were also really entrepreneurial themselves. And I don't think I realized it at the time.
Yeah.
But all of those people that I was close with throughout my childhood and growing up all went on to do really entrepreneurial things as well.
I think that's I think that's super interesting, Bill. I don't know if you have the same experience growing up, but when you look, and even today, right, look at kind of your base of friends, I imagine, because we have a lot of overlap with our circles, there's more entrepreneurs. But I think you realize it or not, or you don't realize that you tend to gravitate to those that kind of have that same itch, or maybe they're also unhirable, which I've always felt for most of my life. But that's interesting you said that, you know, it's like, hey, these are people that I gravitate to. And I'm sure that's also been consistent as you've kind of gone through your career, as far as the other people you want to associate with.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, especially running your own company, and you know, whether it's being on like the entrepreneurial side of things or on like the executive side of things, it can also be like a really lonely place that ultimately very few people understand, right? And so I typically find myself gravitating to and getting along with people who understand the stuff that I'm kind of constantly thinking about or stressed yep. over or have kind of become obsessed over.
The one thing I'll say is being a CEO, you know, could be the loneliest job out there. And that's why I believe having a strong co-founder and having a strong co-founder that happens to be your brother, might be hitting the lottery.
It's unfair.
Yeah, it's unfair. It's unfair. So there's a lot. Hold on. There's a lot of shit we got to unpack here. So number one, we didn't talk about the fact that you met your wife in college. Yeah. And have you been together ever since then?
No. We knew each other in college.
Oh, you didn't date in college?
We did not date in college. But her roommate and, you know, arguably like her best friend was my closest girlfriend in college.
Girl space friend, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Closest girl space friend. And we would see each other a bunch, and it would be like in passing, and it was like she was always one of these people, like I'd say like hello to, hey, what's up, and then you just like you keep walking, you don't even like wait to listen to the response. And she would do the same thing to me. So there was like a general awareness, but never anything kind of meaningful.
Interesting. Yeah, we'll get back to that. The other thing that unpack is, you know, Zephyr went through, you know, you said you've never seen anything like $100 million. So I, at the same time you were at Zephyr, I was at DoubleClick. And I was actually thinking about this the other day. We did at DoubleClick, because I worked for the CFO, we did a $800 million convertible debt round, mm-hmm. You know, literally right before the dot-com bust happened. Wow. I maintain to this day that had we not done that round, DoubleClick would not be in existence. Like literally they wouldn't have made it through. That's how bad the dot-com bust was. Yeah. I don't want to skip ahead, but I feel like it's important. M Particle just announced yep. that you had raised a slew of money literally weeks before COVID and the pandemic happened. Is that, you know, and by the way, a lot of great companies, because we all know DoubleClick ended up with Google, and it's, you know, basically all of Google's non-search monetization, like, and literally it wouldn't have gotten through the dot-com bust, you know.
Yeah.
There are going to be a lot of stories that come out, you know, over the next month and year of like, hey, this company did X and survived it. Had it not, there's going to be a lot of companies that don't survive. Like, do you think M Particle is the new DoubleClick? Like, had you not raised this money literally weeks ago, you know, do you think you'd been able to get through this?
It's tough to say. I mean, obviously we're extremely fortunate to have raised the round.
And how much money did you raise?
So we raised $45 million.
Amazing.
So, we're really lucky that the timing worked out the way it did. You know, admittedly, we had closed the round like a month prior, so it wasn't down to the wire as much as it seemed. Like the announcement was much closer. But I mean, look, you know. The one thing I'll say is that, like, I've always and my parents have always kind of made fun of me about this, but like I've always said things just kind of naturally tend to work out for me. And I don't know if that's because like I have somebody or something kind of looking over me for whatever reason, probably because they know I can't do it on my own. But I've always got like really, really lucky. And I think this is just another example of that. But I would also say that, you know, in the times that we're dealing with today, with respect to COVID and, you know, the pandemic, you're seeing kind of a clear bifurcation of businesses that are becoming stronger and businesses that have become so weak that I think they're ultimately going to go away. We had a really strong Q1, one of our best quarters ever.
Yep.
And we have incredible pipeline for Q2 and the rest of the year. And so when you think about the types of things that we help companies with, it's about moving data for the purpose of driving digital transformation and customer experience. And never has that been more important than it is today. So I would also argue, you know, even if we raise less money or potentially no money, I think that these are tailwinds for businesses like us.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. Sorry to cut us off the linear timeline here, but I thought it was poignant.
Timely and poignant.
Yeah. And we want to come back. Okay, we want to come back to M Particle. Love to hear for our viewers your InnerClick journey.
And when you decided to start InnerClick, where you were, was it after?
What you were wearing, or how and where did that? Talk to us a little about that journey, and also curious, you know, from kind of assembling. This is your first company. You've been an analyst. You learned a lot. You're now ready. You saw an opportunity. I'd like to explore that. I also think it's really interesting. I believe a lot of great companies are born out of either a high level of pain or frustration. I don't know if that's the case for you. That's something I've seen. But how did it come about? And then what was how did you and your brother sort of say, let's go attack this? And then again, for our viewers, maybe just explain what InnerClick was as well as you can, because I think you remember.
Yeah, so from Zephyr, then I went to Accenture for a few years. I got bored of being on bad projects in bad cities. And I was like, I just got to get off the road. I took a job at a small healthcare consulting firm in Boston. And I basically just like took the first, you know, pretty good job offer I got. And I got there the first day and I was like, oh shit, I screwed up. Like, this is, I don't want to be here. And so.
Was that your mulligan? Everyone always seems to have a mulligan on the res.
Yeah, I think I have probably a couple, but that was like when you know, and it was like day one, minute two, and it was just like, oh boy, I really screwed this one up. But I'm here, and I'm gonna give it a month or so before I kind of make that final determination. And so a week later, I was like, I'm done. I'm toast.
My mulligan was 3 days.
Yeah,
literally. I went to a company and I quit on the third day.
Yeah,
that was my mulligan. Like,
you know, congrats for having that conviction. Like, I think I was like a little bit too scared to admit that I made such a bad mistake, because it's not easy. But no. when you know, you know.
Yeah. No. When you know, you know. It's unbelievable. So you were miserable there. Is that when you said, fuck it, I gotta start a company?
Well, I had been talking to a good buddy of mine who he had started a separate company, and he had some ideas based on some of the things that he was seeing. And so it wasn't that the, you know, InnerClick was born out of this pain or this massive vision. It was based on some things that a friend of mine had seen, and he felt like there was a pretty good, at least short term, opportunity. And I knew nothing about digital advertising. I knew nothing about advertising.
Yep.
It was just something that I was never interested in. But I felt like, just coming off of a few years at Accenture, I got good at Excel and PowerPoint and could analyze numbers. And you know, the early vision for InterClick, we were effectively like an ad broker. And so we were doing, this is like mid 2000s, right? So we were arbitraging a lot of media and building relationships, and we got really profitable really quickly. So we started the company literally with like $30,000, and we were, I think, 90 days in, we had like $1 million in the bank, right? Because you could do that. You could do that back.
Oh, wait, wasn't it ringtones? I'm trying to remember. Aren't it was like slinging.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it was anything. Like we were brokering affiliate deals. We were creating our own relationships and OEMing certain products. It was just about the hustle, right? I think when we first started, or when we first met, you were a Didit. That was the product that we brought to you guys, was this ringtone offering.
So for people going, what the hell is a ringtone business? Explain it.
Well, before
with a straight face.
I think some people will remember this, but like before smartphones, you could buy premium ringtones. So instead of like the standard ringtone that your phone came with, you could play a song, or you could play a jingle, or it was like music, right?
Yeah,
and, you could customize it for like 99 cents.
And Chris, these were flip phones. There were no smartphones back then. So
got it. I won't share what I have on here at the table. MK, was Ari Trousdale's thumb play in that same?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they were like one of the big players. We were like, we were the small guys. Pretty lean, really profitable, but that was a tough business because you were dealing.
That's like a nice, eloquent way of saying you were the better business. You were the lean, profitable one. They were the big ones.
Well, they exited for a few $100 million, so I definitely don't think we were the better one.
How big did InterClick? Can you give us give a review? Kind of how big did InterClick get?
Well, when did your brother join InterClick? Did you talk about this friend that you had? When did you grab your brother to start building shit for you?
Pretty much right after my friend's father handed me the check and was like, "Hey, make this work because I'm not gonna write another one." I was like, "Well, now I gotta start building some stuff, or if we're gonna use third party technology, I need some sort of technical oversight." And my brother was. He was still working at an ed tech company at the time. And I was like, look, I just need some like technical guidance, like kind of help me figure out what I need to do. And then as it became more serious, pretty quickly, then we kind of came together and was like, look, you're the tech dude. I'm the business guy. Let's run with this.
Nice.
Yeah. So this is 2005 or so, and we were in Boston. We were working out of a place called the CIC, the Cambridge Innovation Center. We were one of the first tenants there, which was like WeWork before there was a WeWork. Really cool space. And
surrounded by people from MIT and Harvard.
Basically. Yeah. We got to a point where we were like, we gotta like control our own destiny and build out the first like our own technology. I think we were using like whatever like FastClick or ValueClick's ad server was back in the day. I forget the
name of it.
But we're like, we gotta control our own destiny. And at that point, we're a year in, and I just become like obsessed. It was like every free moment that I had, it was learning about digital advertising. And I think like as our learning curve started to flatten out, like our growth curve started to accelerate, right? It was like, if we kind of keep going, there's a really good business here. And my business partner, the guy who had like the original idea, called me up. I'll never forget. I was like, this is like summer of 2007, I was like in the middle of getting a haircut. I was like, hey, what's up, man? He's like, we shot the shit for a little bit. And then he's like, so how's business? I was like, good. I think we're on pace to do, you know, potentially like 10 million in revenue this year. He's like, 10 million. Holy shit. Like, that's incredible. Let's sell. And I was like, well, like, things are starting to go really well. Like, why would we sell? And, you know, like, I think he was looking at it more from the perspective of like, well, he was just the investor. He wasn't like operational. Yeah. And so he's like, if I can even, you know, get $10 million for this business, I've turned, you know, 30 grand into a large chunk of, you know, $10 million. And so it put us in a kind of weird spot. Me and him talked about it over the course of the next few days, but, you know, we ended up basically agreeing to disagree. I wanted to stay with the business and see it through. And he wanted to get out. And, like no VC was going to invest in us at that point. Cause it's like, well, why is one co-founder cashing out? And then we were obviously like way too small for private equity. And so we found some non-traditional investors that were based down in Miami. And we did this whole reverse merger and became a public company, traded over the counter, and kind of dealt with like a bunch of weird shit over the course of the next couple of years. But
do you regret that move? So just for the viewers, you know, going public is usually like this huge event, and you go on a roadshow and teach investors about your business. You know, the route that Ent went down was basically merge in with an existing public shell. So you don't kind of get that whole roadshow and analysts picking you up. Do you regret doing that, or do you just think it's part of just your path?
I don't regret it, because it's not like we can go back in time. And I think hanging on to regrets is not super healthy or productive. Would I recommend it to anybody else? Fuck no. No way. We did it.
Great way to put it.
As hard as humanly possible. I mean, it is really hard, and it creates a number of challenges that I could probably spend an entire hour talking about. So I don't think it's a recommended path, but it was at the time really our only option to get cash into the business and to get my business partner, who at that point wasn't helping the business. Yeah. Out of the business.
Well, you said it, you said it yourself. I mean, you needed capital, and there's alternative ways of raising money. The convention, you know, you either do it sort of as a standalone, or you raise from venture and you give up equity, or maybe there's a debt facility. This is what you had to do. But I do agree that I think the glamour of kind of IPO from when we all grew up in the space has sort of dissipated. So can you, because we want to get to M Particle. Just
yeah, absolutely.
Talk a little bit, MK, talk a little bit about the sale to Yahoo. I think there may have been some turbulence through that period. Would love to give and share any insight or learnings about what happened and what you're at liberty to or want to talk about through that period.
Yeah, so I'll just kind of bridge the gap real quick. So we were, you know, we were this small, obscure ad network. We were late to the market. We were undercapitalized. We operated through the last recession, 2008 to 2009. We grew 150% that year, and then 2009, we grew 100% again. And so, at the end of 2009, we uplisted to NASDAQ. Did more of like a real IPO, albeit like a small one, became like a real public company, and then operated that way for the next couple of years. Had Bill join the board of Interclick in 2011. And then Yahoo came to us later that year. They were one of our big partners, so they had a front row seat to a lot of our growth. And they were like, look, you know, we love what you guys have done. We have this vision to create premium media and to supplement it with premium ad targeting capabilities. And our you know, our personalization and our ad targeting products have become antiquated, and we love what you guys have built. And, you know, would you have any interest in kind of joining forces and hopefully having kind of 1 + 1 = 3? And we're like, great. It got me out of operating as a public company CEO.
Yep.
You know, it gave me kind of like the validation that I think like all kind of first time entrepreneurs want, where it's like, all right, I'm actually, you know, halfway decent at this thing. And it kind of gave us, an opportunity to go bigger, further, faster. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, within a month, there was the first CEO change. And then 2 months later, there was the next CEO change. And then 2 months after that, there was another CEO change. And then 2 months after that, there was another CEO change, right? And then you had like all this.
I remember those headlines coming out, and it was just insane how many new leaders came through that period.
But let me ask you a question. So, first time entrepreneur, you know, you do this, you know, weird, you know, merge into a public company, but then you actually, you know, achieve it. You're a public company CEO. You then sell a company to an S&P 500 major, you know, company. You know, you have created, everyone who knows InterClick knew, like, the InterClick guys, you didn't know, you know, like, you were scared of them, you love them, but I think everyone from the outside looking in was like, man, that's a tight group of people who will seemingly do anything for each other. I think a lot of talent came out of InterClick. So, you know, and you were passionate, like, I mean, you were so freaking passionate about the business and your people. Like, did it ever dawn on you that, like, hey, I can, like, with 4 CEO changes, like, fuck this, I could be running this company. Like, did it ever dawn on you to, hey, I'm gonna become an executive at an S&P 500 company?
Yeah, well, like, interestingly enough, the day that Marissa got announced as CEO, and so at that point, Ross Levinson was interim CEO. They brought Mike Barrett in as CRO. Mike and I had grabbed lunch, and we were talking about me being the COO. And that was lunch. So that was like 12:30. By like 4 o'clock, the news broke that Ross was out, Marissa was in. I was like, so I texted him. I was like, well, I guess that's not happening. He's like, yeah, I was supposed to get on a plane. I left the airport and I'm going home.
Wow, never knew that.
And so it also had a lot to do with me starting another company too, because I think my time at Yahoo made me realize that the team that we had put together at InterClick was really special, and that I don't think that we got necessarily the credit that we deserved, because I looked at the executives at Yahoo and was like, these guys are knuckleheads, and we're better than them at every level, and like, we need to build again and prove that to ourselves and to the world. But yeah, I think it became really clear really fast. Well, two things. One, I thought like we'd be able to go in there and like change the place.
Yeah,
it was too broken to fix. And then the second thing was like, there's just, you know, there's levels to this, and I think we're really good.
And Ken, at this period before M Particle, were you kind of a product centric leader? Did you have kind of a commercial side? I mean, obviously I know you're not coding, but at this stage, just before we get into InterClick, kind of maybe describe where you were gravitating to, where you felt like your skill sets and what you were kind of excelling at, like what were those things that you felt that you kind of were able to shine the most in helping your company?
Well, I think stylistically, I've always tried to lead by being on the front lines, right? And so continuing to be in market, not on every deal, but on, you know, the strategic ones, and I kind of pop into certain deals here and there to show executive support, and our mantra at M Particle is to make business personal, not just like through technology, but also the way that we approach business.
Love that, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. And so, like, I've always looked at my job as CEO like what I do is I create equilibrium, right? My job is not to be the best product person or the best operations person or the best salesperson or certainly not the best engineer. My job is to make sure that given all of the resources that we have, the demands of the market, the competitive forces, you know, whatever kind of resource constraints there may be, that we're able to, you know, maximize output and we don't become sort of unbalanced or unhinged in any, you know, one or two areas. And so I think that's how I lead. It's kind of to oversee a lot of things and make sure that we're not too far over our skis in any one area.
So MK, you mentioned culture, and I know culture was huge at Interclick. You mentioned you learned it at Zephyr. Do you have any kind of, like, now at mParticle, do you have any kind of corporate brand values that you talk about? And most importantly, now that we're all working from home, leadership has never been more important. So how are you leading your company today?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for us, it's first and foremost is just making sure that communication doesn't break down, right? I don't know about you, but it was like day one of everybody being remote, and probably like two or three processes had surfaced where it was like things were clearly slipping through the cracks. And I was like, wow, that didn't take long. And so that was the first week or two was just digging into all of our processes and our communication protocols to make sure that, like, we weren't dropping the ball anywhere. Yep. And I think, like, we've addressed a number of things, and there's still probably a few things that we need to tighten up there, but in this new environment, it is all about making sure that everybody knows what's going on, because we don't benefit from kind of being able to congregate in, you know, one or two major offices, right? So we're headquartered in New York. We have about 140 people in the company. A little bit more than half of the company works in New York. We have a big presence in San Francisco as well. And so you have to make sure that now that everybody's dispersed, that, you know, good information is able to cascade down from me to the leadership team to everybody else, or else then you end up dealing with not only bad information, but then cultural issues, people gossiping. Yeah. And the rumor mill.
I would think outside of the funding that Bill alluded to earlier that you secured, you know, prior, which obviously was huge. The fact that you've been around a few years and you have some core leadership, we know a lot of your guys, you know, that have been there for a while, and you've had the brand's been out there, you have a customer base. I'd imagine there are advantages of having some processes and infrastructure already in place prior to this new world. Imagine trying to sort of course correct, or if you didn't have sort of this structure in place, but you guys have had a few years under your belt. So this is a good segue into mParticle and maybe to start again from the top. For if you haven't heard of mParticle, what is it, and a little bit about the business?
Yeah, so we are a customer data platform. So you know, the CDP space has become, you know, really hyped up over the past year and a half. There's a lot of companies that identify themselves as CDPs, but the thing that we set out to do 7 years ago when we created the company is exactly what we're doing. So we had a vision based on a number of things that we had done at Interclick and a number of things that we had seen at Yahoo with respect to just the world changing, the introduction of mobile and the shift towards, you know, these fragmented customer experiences and having data reside in lots of different places and having it created in lots of different environments and the need to be able to wrangle all of it and then make it really easy to integrate into lots of other systems. And so, you know, the vision was set really, really early on. I think the way that we talk about it and the opportunity in front of us has definitely evolved and up-leveled. But at the core, we're doing the same stuff that we set out to do, which is to make it easy to get data from certain systems out of them and into other places, right? And it's really just about unification and movement at its core. I think the big difference between starting mParticle and when I started InterClick was that emphasis on culture. So seeing what worked and being like just being more mindful of the culture and the environment that we created and using that more as like this foundational building block rather than this passive thing that just kind of accumulates and evolves over time.
Yeah, one interest. I think it's really interesting that it's so mParticle is 7 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, generally they're, you know, companies have some level of pivot or evolution from their starting point, right, to what they want to be. And that's just whether there's macro forces or environment or whatnot. I think it's pretty unique that the bullseye hasn't really changed that much. And by the way, companies that do have to evolve, that's not a bad thing. There's just things out of their control or their supply changes or whatever it is. But the fact that the core of the business, I actually kind of remember you seeing you and your brother at like Mobile World Congress, like around that time frame when it was just sort of when you guys were just developing the idea. But I think that's super unique that you guys haven't changed course, right? I mean, obviously things change, but the what your strategy or your mission is has not changed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a lot of people when we would talk about the business early on, they'd scratch their heads and be like, "Well, is this or is it like how do I think about it?" And now it's like, "Oh, yeah, okay, all right, you guys." It's like, surprise, surprise, motherfuckers! Like we're actually pretty good at this thing.
Well, but I, by the way, there's no, you know, there's no better form of flattery when you have, you know, some of the largest big tech companies, you know, being fast followers of your business, right? So you have Oracle, Adobe, all who want to get into the CDP space. Yep. And you know, you guys are the category creators.
Yeah.
I mean, that's freaking awesome.
No, it's humbling. I made that comment prior kind of like half kidding, but you know, it's incredible to see like that, you know, the world has kind of caught up to our vision. I think, companies like Adobe and Salesforce and Oracle, like I can only aspire to be, you know, have a fraction of their success over time. They have incredible market share and mind share and staying power, and they've built incredible organizations that operate at just enormous scale. And so for them to say, oh yeah, like what you have done and built is actually the future, like it's incredibly humbling.
It seems like there's the two things that come to mind for me as I've kind of watched your journey from the sideline is being early on mobile. You know, this isn't, it's not that new, right? I mean, so the fact that you guys jumped into mobile and obviously, and then on the data side, so much conversation in ad tech and martech has been, you know, oriented around media and impressions and supply and driving revenue. But you guys were thinking about, I think, a new currency and the value of that currency very early. Obviously, I know there's a lot more, so I'm not trying to say pigeonhole those two things. But from my vantage, kind of being early mobile and kind of the idea that data is fragmented and companies don't have a solution, you know, it's a pretty cool story.
Well, yeah, I think we're at the intersection of probably three of the most important trends in modern business history, which is the move to mobility, big data, and you know, the move to the cloud, right? And we kind of represent all of it, which, you know, we could have been half right in our vision and still had these huge forces behind us and been, I think, at least somewhat successful.
So unfortunately, we're coming on time here. I feel like we can spend another hour diving into, you know, any one of six different things we've covered here. Where do you feel the end game is with M Particle? Is it a sale? Is it another IPO that's done the right way this time? What do you think?
The fuck if I know, man. I've stopped trying to like obsess over the outcome or cross the finish line a long time ago, right? My obsession is in making our customers happy and keeping my employees safe.
Yep.
And I feel like if we're doing that, we're going to have a ton of options, right?
Yep.
And so I love what we do. You know, we talked about culture kind of briefly earlier, but like we have a few kind of cultural norms, and it's like we hold ourselves accountable to being good people. We create value before we extract value. We own our own karma. We create solutions, not excuses, and we have fun, right? We celebrate the wins. And if you're doing all that, every day is pretty good. You don't have to have that outcome, that sale, that IPO to kind of validate everything. Now we have investors and we have to be mindful of them. And we obviously want to return capital, but that's a byproduct of doing the things that you need to do day in and day out.
Yep.
Well said. And imagine it takes time to develop there's probably a lot of companies and CEOs that would love to have those values that you just laid out. I imagine it takes years. I've often found like the employee base and how, you know, the employees and how they orientate around themselves generally draw what the values are. They create it, right? You and Andrew facilitate kind of the vision or whatnot, but your team very much kind of creates over the culture, and it takes time. You don't create your values day one. It takes time to develop that stuff.
Well, I think you can actually. I would argue like we created our values really, really early on, and we said we're only going to hire the types of people that exhibit these values, right?
Yeah, good point.
Like that your values are the DNA of your culture, right? And so you can, like my takeaway from InnerClick was that you can actually deliberately shape your culture.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been, you know, now we've had like a cultural evolution because in the early days of M Particle, our culture was a little bit different. It was like, just get shit done, hold yourself accountable to getting it done, and don't let anything get in your way. But then you get to a point in time where it's less about, you know, fighting for survival, and then you want to build an environment that you're proud of, where if your son or daughter, or if your spouse, or if your parent were to apply to that company, as a job candidate, like would you be proud of what you've built, right? And you know, that's been part of the evolution process for.
Okay, I'm gonna sneak in one more question before we kind of wrap up. And Bill, I know you wanted to touch on the personal side of life and got to hear about your son. So, where I'm spending my time in venture and investing, any insights or learnings in regards to your investors? I know this would also be a very long, could be a long answer and a long conversation, but you know, how did you pick them, or they picked you, but any interesting insights in regards to the backers of M Particle over the last 7 years that you can share?
Well, we had a lot of people. We have a lot of people on the cap table from our seed round. Our Series A was led by Social Capital. I love the fact that, you know, but this is back in 2015. They obviously look a lot different these days, but it was all about disrupting venture and taking a data driven approach to venture investing. And they created their kind of magic eight ball, which is you enter in a bunch of information into some spreadsheet, and you know, at the end result is like a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And I thought that was, that struck a chord with us, obviously building a data platform and then also trying to disrupt the status quo. So felt really culturally aligned there. And then our Series B was led by Bain Capital, and they looked at us during the Series A and they were like, we love what you guys are trying to do. We're just not sure if you can actually do it. And so, you know, we had grown after the Series A, we'd grown like 300% year over year, and they had reached back out. And I was like, well, why am I going to engage if you guys didn't like it last time? Like, what's different? And they're like, well, one, we did like it, and two, we were wrong, and we admit that we were wrong. And I kind of just stepped back and I was like, well, if they're willing to admit that, then I think philosophically we're probably aligned, because as a startup, you have to make a lot of bets, and you're going to be wrong in those bets some of the times, and you have to be self-aware, and you have to acknowledge it in order to continue to move forward. And it was like, you know, I really liked the partner that we had met, a guy named Scott Friend. He's still on our board to this day. He's been awesome to work with. And so like it was kind of really easy because we had already known them and there was some inherent level of trust. And then for the Series C, it was about getting an investor that was local and who understood SaaS as we were starting to scale. And so, look, there's not a ton of great SaaS investors in New York City. I think Mike Brown is at Bowery is one of the best, but he's really early stage. And so we came across Harmony and really liked Mark and the team that he had built. And you know, it's a smaller fund, but it's still a $400 or $500 million fund. So we went with them. And then with our Series D, Arrowroot Capital is they're a growth equity firm out of LA, and they've invested in a number of data platforms and a number of companies that are kind of in and around the CDP space. And so they have just a bunch of conviction and they saw what worked and what didn't work at some of their portfolio companies. And, you know, as you get bigger and bigger, you want as much really specific expertise around the table. At least that's how I
think. Super helpful. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah. That's sounds like you got some great partners over the years. Bill, I'm going to pass it to you for,
yeah. We're wrapping up here, folks, and we went a little over. I apologize, but I feel like we could take another half hour and not even cover everything here. So going into where everyone was kind of going to be stuck in their home, I reach out to you and your wife. Your wife's response was, "Yeah, we're fine with the whole being home." Not the biggest thing she was scared about was actually being with your son for 24 hours a day. So for those of you, the first time I ever met his son, Connor, he was, almost two. And I came in there and he came running down the hallway and he just face planted. I mean, he was running towards us, like all excited that someone was visiting the house, face planted right on his face, right on his nose. Any other kid would get up screaming, kicking. He got up like, just kind of shook it off and then kept running. And that basically explains his personality. So how is little Connor doing? Yeah.
he's a tank. He's loving it. Right. Like I travel a lot for work. And so, for me, getting to spend more time with him throughout the day is awesome. And I think he appreciates it. Look, it's tough not to be like a little bit stir crazy these days, especially. It's not just him, right? We have the two dogs who are both like high maintenance, and then like right before he went on spring break, which just rolled into this like forever break.
Yeah.
Bridget had agreed to watch the school guinea pig. So we now like we have this 4-year-old guinea pig. I think these things only live like 4 or 5 years. This thing's definitely going to die on our watch. And like, it's just chaos. But it's incredible. And I love it. Like these are the times, like, we're going to look back and we're going to be like, you know, that was actually pretty cool.
Yeah. Do you remember when we had the guinea pig in the house? Totally. Yeah. Exactly. I grew up with guinea pigs. I still can't really work out what they are or where they come from, but I don't want to ask any questions.
Yeah. So listen, we really appreciate your time. I think those people in the industry who know InterClick now know mParticle. I think everyone would agree that, like, the employees of InterClick and mParticle, the one thing they had in common was they all had this kind of swagger and this belief that, you know, they were doing something special. And that culture just doesn't happen. That's leadership at the top. I think, you know, people have, you know, kind of like feelings of like who MK is. I'm not sure the people who even know you would be like, wow, I didn't know MK was the guy who, when alcohol consumption is 56% up because everyone's at home, you're not drinking, you're not really watching TV other than Ozark, you're reading a lot of books, you're staying the course. I think you have kind of this focus. You know, you say that luck, you know, just happens to follow you. We all know that's not true. You know, luck is kind of like putting yourself in the right place at the right time with the right team, assembling the right leadership. So while I do believe everyone who is more humble says, hey, I was lucky, you know, because how do I achieve this success without such luck? I think you are much more calculated than people probably think or give you credit for. And so I think that's your overall, that's your superpower, is you have this like focus. I also kind of don't think you're a person who says, hey, I leave my job and now I'm going home. I think you just have your life, and mParticle is just part of your family, like your son or your wife, and you don't have those barriers. So some people will say you're crazy, you never stop working. I just think it's just the culture that you've created. And so that's you know, you put that all together, I think that's your superpower. Chris?
I'm only adding one thing that I wrote down about halfway through the conversation as it relates to the reading and knowing MK a bit and need to spend more time with him is, dude, I think you're just a student of the game. I mean, I think your superpower is that you study, you learn, you observe, you know, you're like a sponge, and taking all those experiences, but you take it really seriously. It's not that other CEOs or founders don't, but you are a student of the game. That's what I think your superpower is.
I love that. I love that. So yep. Ladies and gentlemen, we spent a little over an hour here with Michael Katz, founder of InterClick, sold to Yahoo, founder and CEO of mParticle. Let's see what happens over the next coming months and years.
Let's do it.
MK, thanks for being on the show, man. And good luck with everything. Speak soon, buddy.
Yeah, you too.
Give our best to Bridge and Connor.
And Connor.
Will do.
Cheers.
Superpowers.